Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Hey clinical problem solvers, this is Sarah Honorato, and welcome back for another episode of WDX Women in Diagnosis series, where one of our goals is to feature and elevate the incredible women diagnosticians out there. And today we're so lucky to have two amazing women physicians here with us to discuss a clinical unknown, Dr. Deborah Bynum and Dr. Anne-Marie Kumpfer.
Yes, I'm so excited for this episode, Sarah. Thanks for starting us off. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce Dr. Kumpfer. Anne-Marie Kumpfer is a new residency graduate and academic hospitalist at UNC. After completing medical school at Texas Tech University, she moved up to North Carolina for a residency. She liked UNC so much that she decided to stay as an academic hospitalist after completing residency in June. She also serves as a section editor for our friends, the Human Diagnosis Project. She's passionate about diagnostic reasoning, teaching, and guacamole. And can I just say, for those of our audience who actually joins us in Virtual Morning Report, Anne-Marie is one of the most incredible voices. So if you're not joining us on Virtual Morning Report, please do. You're missing out on her incredible teachings, pearls, and diagnostic reasoning. And I'm so excited for you all to hear her brilliance.
Thanks, Charmaine. And I have the honor of introducing Dr. Deborah Bynum. Dr. Bynum is the director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program at the University of North Carolina. Originally from Eastern North Carolina, she graduated from Davidson in 1990 with a degree in biology and a focus on ecology and marine biology. From there, she came to Chapel Hill for medical school and stayed at UNC for residency training. After completing a year as chief resident, she joined the faculty at Wake Med Hospital, where she worked in the clinic caring for Raleigh's underserved, attended on the inpatient service with UNC residents and students, and helped to found one of the first hospitalist programs in the area. After 3 years at Wake Med, she returned to UNC for further training as a fellow in the geriatric medicine program and was appointed to a faculty position in 2001. During the subsequent 14 years, she has held multiple leadership positions within the School of Medicine, the Department of Medicine, and the Geriatric Medicine Fellowship and Internal Medicine Residency Programs. She directed the acting internship for senior students, as well as co-directed the clinical skills course for second-year students, served on the School of Medicine Education Committee, and helped to design, implement, and co-direct both a transition course for new third-year students, as well as a teaching elective for fourth-year students. She served as the program director for the Geriatric Medicine Fellowship from 2008 to 2014 and was selected to lead the Internal Medicine Residency Program in May of 2014.
Woohoo! Welcome to you both. I'm so excited. Thank you for being here. Sarah, do you want to get us started with the case?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll dive right into the first aliquot. So this case, our patient is a 49-year-old woman. She's presenting with an acute onset 10 out of 10 headache that began earlier on the morning of presentation. So a little bit more history. The patient reports that she was in her usual state of health until the morning of admission when she noticed a severe onset headache associated with right eye pain. She was unloading some groceries from her car when she first noticed the headache, which she rates as a constant 10 out of 10 pain that is mostly on the right side of her head and surrounding her right eye. She tried taking Tylenol for the headache without any relief, and nothing else has seemed to make it better or worse. She does not notice a positional nature and states that it has been constant and not worse at any particular time of day. She reports that pain with movement of the right eye, photophobia, and double vision that she notices is worse when both eyes are open and improves on closing either eye. She denies any trauma or foreign body to the eye and denies any problems with the left eye. She states that she typically gets migraine headaches several times per week, but the current headache is more intense and feels different in nature than her typical headaches. And that concludes aliquot one.
When approaching this case, when I'm approaching someone presenting with a headache, one of the first things I want to think through is this a primary headache or a secondary headache? And if this is a secondary headache, are there any alarm signs present? So we know that this patient has a history of migraine headache, but just because there's a primary headache syndrome present doesn't mean that should make us think that a secondary headache syndrome is less likely in this case. And so I'm seeing several alarming symptoms right here. The fact that the headache is a 10 out of 10 headache, the fact that there's associated symptoms, including photophobia
and double vision, and the headache has been constant, and that someone with a history of migraines felt that this headache was bad enough to present with care. And so this is something where I'm going to want to be thinking about a secondary headache syndrome, and it needs to be worked up really aggressively in this case. So some things I'm going to be thinking about and wanting to know more about is past medical history. Is there any history of diabetes, cardiovascular risk factors, anything like that? Is there any immunosuppression that could raise concern for an infectious etiology, any history of elevated ocular pressures that could raise concern for glaucoma or things of that nature? And then any new or different medications or infections of surrounding structures like a sinus infection, ear infection, or something of that nature. And so those are kind of the things I'm going to want to dig into the past medical history, and then kind of layering on the information that we have a headache, we have alarm features. And so we're going to try to figure out how the photophobia will factor into it and the double vision. So we're told that the double vision gets better when covering an eye, which makes me wonder if there's some sort of ocular misalignment. And so then I'm going to be thinking about, you know, are there any cranial nerve involvement? And if there are, could this be a sign of a cavernous sinus process? Could this be a sign of something in the orbit of the eye itself? Some sort of infarction or things like that. And then I'm going to be layering on kind of clot. Could there be a clot? Could there be an infection there that's causing the symptoms? And then I'm going to want to really closely examine the eye itself, because it seems like the pathology is centered around the eye and the cranial nerves. And so I'm going to want to see, do I see any redness of the eye? Is there signs of uveitis there? Is the pupil equal and reactive to light? Because that could point to involvement of the ocular motor nerve, or is there signs concerning for glaucoma?
Great job, Anne-Marie. I always love listening to Anne-Marie. She was always the resident in Morning Report who would just have great input and clinical reasoning. And I absolutely agree. I think when I was listening to this, lots of red flags very quickly came up, right, that made me want to proceed very quickly with the workup for this patient. And I think Anne-Marie really outlined them nicely. The fact that it was sudden onset, 10 out of 10, and then the associated features, especially the diplopia, the photophobia, and the pain with eye movement. Pain with eye movement is another thing I zero in on as being specific to a few different things. It starts making me think optic neuritis or orbital infections, that sort of thing. So I feel like zeroing in on some of the key features as well that make the headache unique, not only alarming, but some of the unique features to the eye pain that she's having, I think will help with the diagnosis. The other history that I would like would be any prior neurological symptoms at all. Again, migraine history in and of itself can actually predispose to other neurological issues in women. She's 49 as well. So I'd want to know if she had any, in the last preceding years, any other neurological symptoms that might, again, make you worry about optic neuritis or something along that route as well.
You both are so brilliant. I'm so happy just listening to you all talk medicine. It's fantastic. Can't wait to hear more.
Yeah, totally agree. Amazing start to the discussion. I'll provide a little bit more history and information to you both now. So some additional history about the patient's current presentation. So her review of systems is notable for an 8 to 10 pound unintentional weight gain over the last several months. She notes that she feels weaker than normal also. She otherwise denies any fevers, chills, fatigue, no changes in her stool or changes in body hair pattern, no galactorrhea at all. And she's currently menstruating at the time of your interview with her. In terms of some more of her past medical history and medications, as mentioned previously, she does have a history of migraine headaches for which she takes Fiorasat as needed. She has a history of papillary thyroid cancer. It was diagnosed 2 years prior to the current admission, and she underwent total thyroidectomy and is currently on Synthroid for a thyroid replacement. Otherwise, she has a history of hypertension that was diagnosed 1 year prior to the current admission, and she's currently on 10 milligrams of amlodipine daily. And finally, she has a Nexplanon in place for contraception, and that was placed 3 years prior to the current presentation. In terms of other health-related behaviors for the patient, she states that she drinks 1 to 2 drinks of alcohol per week. She denies any tobacco use and denies any other substance use. In terms of her social history, she lives in New England with her husband and 3 children. She works as a nursing assistant, and she denies any recent travel outside of the area. And that concludes aliquot 2.
So looking into the past medical history, I always think that's really helpful in a case like this. We're going to want to layer it on. So here, kind of the additional history of weight gain can be a really important clue as to what could be going on. When thinking of a differential for weight gain, there's a lot of different factors in play. Sometimes weight gain can be due to excess calories or stressors, which can lead to decrease in, you know, time, physical activity and things like that. But then you also want to be thinking is, could there be an abnormality in the endocrine system that could be driving this weight gain? And so here, looking for clues such as fat distribution, if there were signs of a buffalo hump or central obesity, you could be thinking about, could this be a cortisol-mediated process driving it? Or if they were striae or easy bruising or things like that. And if it's a cortisol-mediated process, you know, we'd be thinking about how could that be related to the headache? And so, you know, there's a lot of different things that could be going on. We could also be thinking about hypothyroidism as well. If perhaps she has been unable to take her thyroid replacement, or perhaps something's going on where she's not able to absorb her thyroid replacement. And so here, I just want to be thinking about, could this weight gain be a clue to the other pathology going on here? I'll let Dr. Bynum address the past medical history.
That was great, Amory. Also, I was wondering, the weight gain is interesting, and it made me also think, is there something endocrine going on? The fact that she is continuing to have normal menses makes pituitary issues a little less likely, since that's earlier affected. So I'm not sure what to make of her weight gain unless she's not able to exercise as much. It's interesting. I'd like to know more about the weakness. Is it diffuse weakness? Again, are there any history of focal neurological issues that she has had? Does she have difficulty climbing stairs? What exactly her weakness is would be really my next specific history to get, and when we get to exam as well. And then I'm not sure how to tie her thyroid cancer in yet. I've been trying.
Excellent. I will provide some more information about the exam now. So in terms of physical exam for the patient, so her vital signs when you see her, her temperature is 37. Her blood pressure is 160 over 85, the heart rate of 78. She's sitting 98% on room air, and her BMI is 38. Her general appearance, she appears tired and has difficulty opening her eyes due to pain. She's sitting in the dark when you go to see her in the emergency department. Her HEENT exam, you note inversion of the right eye with limited abduction, and the left eye appears normal. On skin exam, you note some mild bruising on her bilateral forearms and shins. No areas of hyperpigmentation and no obvious striae on exam. And then for her neuro exam, she's ANO times 3. She's conversant but appears uncomfortable. Her visual acuity is 20 over 25 bilaterally. Her visual fields are full to confrontation bilaterally. She's able to count fingers equally and accurately in all quadrants without any blurring in any parts of the visual field in either eye. Her right eye does have restricted range of motion, and she's unable to abduct past midline on the right eye. Her left eye has a full range of motion. Her strength is 5 out of 5 in the bilateral upper and lower extremities, both proximally and distally. Though she might, you're not sure whether she seems maybe a little bit weaker, like a 4+ out of 5 in the proximal upper extremities. And the remainder of her neuro exam is unremarkable. And the remainder of her physical exam, including a cardiovascular exam, a pulmonary exam, abdominal and extremities, are also all unremarkable. And that concludes the physical exam.
Okay, so first, when addressing this, vital signs can give a lot of information here. If a fever can show signs of inflammation, although lack of fever does not rule out inflammation. And then the blood pressure we see is hypertensive with a wide pulse pressure. And so here we're thinking about, could this be related to our differential? Hypertension is very common, but it could be a sign of pain, of some sort of endocrine abnormality, of risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And so there might be some information here. And so we're just going to keep this in the back of our mind that this is here because it could aid in the differential. And then the elevated BMI could give some information. We know there's weight gain. We could also be thinking about pseudotumor cerebri or things like that, if that could be contributing. Going through the exam, the most prominent thing that we see are related to the eye, which does have to do with our, you know, differential here. We thought in the first aliquot that things centered around the right eye, and that is confirmed here. We see limited abduction of the eye, which I have to remember my cranial nerves, which is difficult to do when talking. I think it might be cranial nerve 3, but it could be 6. I'm going to just pause and think about that.
And Mary, I always like have to draw things out, look at pictures, think through. I'm like, which one did what? So you're not alone in that at all, my friend.
So Amory, yeah, it gets very complicated, but I also think about 6 nerve palsies as far as not being able to abduct the eye. And so your eye is going to be turned more in, but it does get confusing. And I think the combination, again, I go back to worrying about optic neuritis because just a simple cranial nerve palsy shouldn't give you eye pain. Eye pain is with movement is very, again, not something that you see normally when people have a cranial nerve palsy. Cranial nerve palsies can be due to, again, I think you brought this up in the beginning, any sort of compression there at the base of the with all the nerves at the cranial base. It can be due to a mass in the area. It can be due to infarction. Sometimes we see this in patients who have diabetes and small vessel disease in the area can present with cranial nerve palsies. But again, pain with eye movement, not usually something I think about with just a cranial nerve palsy. So having cranial nerve abnormalities plus pain with eye movement makes me, again, worried that there's something else going on. And I also thought about pseudotumor originally, and that actually can cause vision loss as well. She's a little bit older than some of the women that we see with pseudotumor. I think usually a little bit younger, but definitely still on the differential.
Thinking about how the easy bruising could play in here and the weight gain and everything. One differential, which to keep in mind is, could there be some sort of Cushing syndrome leading to some sort of cavernous sinus or other process like mucormycosis or something like that. And so we're just going to want to keep a really good eye on what the glucose is because that will give us a lot of information here. And so I'm still very much wondering about a cavernous sinus process, but then also with the pain with extraocular movement, I am thinking about, is it something, could it be something farther up in the eye as well?
And I agree, cavernous venous thrombosis would definitely be high on my differential as well. Mm-hmm. And I think can cause the pain and the nerve palsy and the sudden onset as well makes you worry for that.
Mm-hmm. And if it's cavernous sinus, is it an infectious process or is it thrombosis itself? Because both could be on the differential.
Awesome discussion, everyone. It's great to hear you both talk through a very complicated patient case. So I'll provide a little bit more data now with some labs and some initial imaging that we have for the patient. So in terms of labs for her, she had a bunch of labs drawn on arrival. She had a CBC with a white count of 13.5, a hemoglobin and hematocrit of 13.9 and 39.6 respectively. Platelets were 313. Her BMP, sodium of 140, potassium of 3.4, a chloride of 100, a bicarb of 26, BUN was 15, creatinine 0.63, and her glucose was 172. She had a series of endocrinologic labs that were also drawn on arrival. She had an ACTH drawn at 6 in the morning that was 46. with a corresponding cortisol drawn simultaneously that was elevated at 78.2. She had a TSH that was 1 and a free T4 that was correspondingly 1.4. She had an LH and FSH drawn, which were 0.6 and 2.1 respectively, and an estradiol, which was 8. She had a prolactin of 30. The reference range for that was 4.8 to 23.3. And she had a growth hormone and an IGF-1 both drawn and within normal limits. And then in terms of imaging, on arrival, she had a CTA of the head and neck that showed no acute intracranial abnormality or acute cervical or intracranial vascular pathology. She also had an MRI of the head that showed a 1.6 by 1.2 centimeter peripherally enhancing pituitary mass with paracellar extension along the right cavernous sinus and supracellar extension with compression of the optic chiasm. That concludes this aliquot, and the next aliquot will reveal the final diagnosis.
Okay, so looking at these labs, there is mild leukocytosis, which is nonspecific. Leukocytosis can be a sign of infection, but it can also be a sign of stress and cortisol excess. And so here, it's another thing I'm just going to be thinking about and thinking how it could play into it, but it's not specific. And then the other data I'm looking at is the slightly low potassium. It's 3.4, so only a little bit decreased. But then again, you're wondering, is this an effect of the hormone system? Is the low potassium due to excess hormone levels that are driving it as well? And then there's mild hyperglycemia that could also be kind of contributing to our hypothesis that maybe there is some hormonal component causing hyperglycemia. And then when you also want to be thinking about when normal isn't normal. So here we have an ACTH level that's normal, but it's not normal for the degree of cortisol. The ACTH should be suppressed because of how high the cortisol is. So this normal lab is abnormal because you would expect with a high cortisol for there to be suppression there. And so here we're thinking that the ACTH is probably driving this process and driving the cortisol up. And so if we know that the ACTH is elevated and driving excess cortisol, and that seems to be driving the weight gain, the bruising, everything that we've seen so far. And so then the question is, where is this excess ACTH coming from? Is it coming from the pituitary, or is it being released somewhere else in the body? Here with the vision abnormalities, we have to be thinking about, could it be coming from the pituitary? The thyroid labs look within the normal limits. And then looking at the other labs, quickly looking at LH, FSH, estradiol, they look on the low side. You said she was menstruating right now?
That's correct, yes.
Also, I'd love to see her calcium level. Again, now I'm starting to think, you know, is this actually associated with her papillary thyroid cancer as well? And is this actually a pituitary malignancy, which we normally think of benign pituitary tumors, but with this, does she actually have an MEN syndrome, right? And have a pituitary tumor in addition to her papillary thyroid cancer? Are we seeing an MEN syndrome? Is that what to explain multiple endocrine neoplasms in her? I believe it would be an MEN1, but that stretches back to med school a little bit.
I would agree. Dr. Bynum, do you want to further discuss the imaging?
I don't know exactly she's got a pituitary mass, right? And she has paracellular extension. I think the compression on the optic nerve explains her physical exam findings. It's not huge, right? It's a little over a centimeter, which goes along with, again, some of the labs that we're seeing. Usually when we think of benign pituitary lesions, this is the other thing that worries me with some of the enhancement that we're seeing on the MRI findings. Usually benign findings, that just doesn't sound as benign as what we usually see. Also, we usually see prolactinomas tend to be the more common, just benign tumors, and those are going to be associated. If it's a pituitary tumor of that size, usually from my memory, again, the prolactin levels are going to be greater than 200, not 30. 30 is sort of a little bit of prolactin elevation, not a macroadenoma prolactinoma elevation. 200 is usually the levels that we see. So again, I'm more worried that this is actually not just a benign pituitary tumor for her.
And I think the fact that it's going extending into the cavernous sinus points to that it's a more aggressive tumor. And I would be more concerned about a carcinoma or something malignant in nature. So it looks like the next aliquot is going to reveal the final diagnosis. So I guess we've got to put our nickel down, so to speak. So we know that this is a Cushing syndrome and due to a pituitary tumor, and we think it might be a carcinoma, but also worried with the prior, was it a thyroid issue, that maybe there could be a MEN syndrome. Normally I think about a parathyroid hyperplasia with MEN type 1, but it's certainly something in the differential and something that I'd be speaking more to endocrine about. Do you have anything to add to that, Dr. Bynum?
Yeah, so I'd want to know her calcium levels, because again, I think parathyroid also travels with this. But again, the pituitary tumor, the papillary thyroid cancer, and then parathyroid. I always remember the P's together for ME.
The three P's.
The three P's, exactly. So again, it's seeming a little bit suspicious for multiple issues now.
Also have to think about, could there be some other, like a P53 mutation or some other genetic predisposition? And so I think thinking about genetic counseling, talking to the colleagues, we need to get a sample to get the pathology, but then thinking about, could the two processes be related? And also, I guess, I don't know if she got radiation in the past, because that could also predispose to later malignancies.
Just before Sarah reveals the final diagnosis, I just kind of wanted to jump in and say it's been such a privilege to hear you both dissect a case. I personally find endocrinopathies quite challenging, so it was so fantastic to see you both tackle like a neuro finding, the neuro exam, all of these hormone labs, and just being so systematic and thoughtful in your discussion. It was absolutely privileged to hear you both discuss it. Thank you.
Trying to go back in my brain and remember some of the morning resident reports that Anne Marie had done, because she comes up with these amazing infographics. And I was trying to pull from my head some of those, because I think you've actually put together several with multiple endocrine pathways, Anne Marie.
Happened, and I'm wishing that I had now.
My brain. I was trying to find them and bring them back out.
I know.
But that is the perfect plug to remind everybody to. Anne Marie makes this incredible tutorials and infographics. So that's where I've learned a lot from her. So please follow her on Twitter. She has a lot of great knowledge nuggets to share. Sarah, do you want to tell us what happens next?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you both for an amazing discussion. You brought up things that I don't even think we were thinking about when we saw this patient, but I wish that we had, because they're just such amazing learning points and teaching points in there. So I will wrap up the case now and tell you all what happened. So the patient was evaluated by neurosurgery, and given the persistent oculomotor dysfunction and the other symptoms she was experiencing, as well as the imaging findings, they were most concerned for a pituitary mass, and specifically pituitary apoplexy of that mass. So they took her actually emergently for a transsphenoidal resection of the mass that they had seen on imaging. Intraoperatively, they found a hemorrhagic mass in the pituitary with displacement of the normal pituitary gland to the left. And a biopsy was taken, and immunohistochemistry was positive for ACTH. The final diagnosis in this case was an ACTH secreting pituitary adenoma causing Cushing's disease, as you all pointed out. At discharge, her ophthalmoplegia had not yet completely resolved. She was discharged on some steroids with plan for follow-up in endocrinology clinic. And so that was the case. Thank you again both so much for all of your wisdom and a great discussion.
Thank you both so much. Any reflections or any thoughts that you would like to share with us?
Just an amazing case. And I'm sure everyone, again, it just goes up. I think our first thought was, did she have a bleed or something like that? And the pituitary apoplexy had gone through my mind. But then I guess I got a little sidetracked with the fact that she was still having menses. But the fact that she was currently menstruating, right? So that kind of throws all of that off. So that was, I think, an interesting part of this case as well. Had she had the hemorrhagic event probably a month or two ago, she might not have had, she might not have presented menstruating. So that was an interesting way to throw us off a little bit.
I always say patients forget to read the textbook that we do.
Yeah, I think just thinking about things globally and really getting that good history, I think getting that history of weight gain and that seeing the bruising on exam and kind of noticing the subtle things that are there that helps make the differential. So thanks so much, Sarah, for presenting such a great case and definitely learned a lot from it.
Was a great case. And I think the other learning point, Amory pointed this out nicely, the ACTH was, although not high, it was abnormally not low, right, with the cortisol level that she had. So I think that was another really good learning point to this case.
Yeah, I was just beaming when you were saying that, Amory, because like abnormally normal labs is like one of my favorite things to discuss. And I nerd out so much on that. So it was just music to my ear hearing you both dissect this case. And while we have you here, I would love to just keep learning from your wisdom. And, after that incredible med talk, I would love to, this is WDX. We love to focus about a lot of opportunities, the barriers that a lot of women face in the field of medicine and especially diagnostic reasoning too. And for our audience, I was wondering if you don't mind sharing some biases that you've noticed in your trainings and how that have shaped you. And more importantly, how did you overcome these as an early trainee when you were making your way through medicine?
I think one experience I noticed was before I was in medical school, when I was a pre-medical student, and sometimes you would meet different people and introduce, and inevitably you talk about, your major and what you're pursuing. And sometimes when I would say, I'm pre-med and I want to go to med school, they would ask me why I didn't want to pursue a different field or a different healthcare profession. And to me, that was really frustrating because I didn't want to have to explain why I wanted to pursue the field that I wanted to do. I was fine with speaking to why I wanted to be a doctor and take care of patients, but I didn't want to have to justify it to other people. And so I think, one thing that has been helpful is just, being really honest, with people when sometimes you get those questions and it's okay to, want to be a doctor, and you don't always have to, feel like you have to justify that to other people.
Yeah, it was a really interesting question when I saw that, thought about this a little bit. It made me really go back. I mean, I matched 26 years ago now. I was doing the interview process. So I've been doing medicine for basically 30 years, med school, residency, and beyond. And just like Anne-Marie said, just having to constantly justify yourself why you're going into medicine, especially 30 years ago, why I wasn't going to be a nurse, why I wasn't going to do something else. And I remember I'd actually been, this is a story that I really hadn't thought about until thinking about this question. My husband and I have been married 26 years. We met in med school. We dated for 3 years in med school. When we got engaged before doing the couples match, my mom asked me if I was going to quit med school. And I just replied, no. I had no desire to quit med school. I was going to be a doctor. And of course, my husband laughed and said that he had gone to med school to marry a doctor. So that kind of diffused. Aww. situation a little bit. But, you know, just I think it ties into, I think you brought this up in the beginning, the thoughts of imposter syndrome and, you know, do you belong in this situation? And I think the ways to deal with it is just to remind yourself of who you are and why you want to do what you want to do. For me, I love seeing the medical school classes now that are 50% women, right? And our residency classes that are 50% women. It's so different, again, than just even 26 years ago. So for me, that constant just seeing all the women faces out there coming along through med school and residency and going into not just medicine, but surgery and orthopedics and urology and neurosurgery. To me, that's what kind of keeps me going is seeing all these young women faces up and coming. So feel like we've come a long way in 26 years and we'll just keep moving forward.
Yeah. That both of you, that was just so beautifully said. And Anne-Marie, I've been there as well. And I think like one of the things that I used to get a lot, because I'm a very like sensitive, emotional person. I can cry so easily. Just show me like a cute YouTube video and tears are rolling down and people being like, you want to be a doctor, but you're so emotional. I'm like, that's a good thing, right? I would worry about myself if I stopped being an emotional person and not caring as much and like having to constantly explain as to why I wanted to be a doctor. And I think at times, like, you know, you just subconsciously just like take it in. And when you have a setback, it just kind of affects you more. And Dr. Bynum, that just made me smile to hear your story and just to hear, as you were mentioning, like classes of med students coming in, all this incredible woman who are just now like want to do any career that they see fit. And I remember just, you know, as a chief doing some like teaching sessions with like our like third year med students and seeing like women in those classes being bold, like asking questions, like really owning their space made me so, so, so proud that I'm like, even in a few years, like we've made such progress. And I'm sure, you know, from your perspective, having to be a residency program director and just constantly seeing the more and more of this incredible woman coming through is like definitely a source of pride. And thank you so much for all of your help in nurturing that too.
Of course, it makes my job fun. It really does.
And one thing that I was like reflecting on, and I would love to hear you, everybody's thought here on, is that, you know, especially over the past year, is about how stressful it's been, both like in medicine and outside medicine. And I was just kind of reflecting on the jobs report that they came out a while ago, that all the jobs lost in the last quarter was like all women, like 150,000 or something of jobs that were lost, and just thinking about the effect that it has both in the at work and also at home with all the roles that we play. And part of me was like thinking about like, you know, the stress of it and how do we deal with stress and how much like as women we carry a lot of it. So I'm curious to see, like, is there anything that has been helpful for you to all deal with stress and like focusing on your well-being both like inside the hospital and outside that you would be willing to share with us?
Yeah, I think, you know, it really has been an incredibly stressful year, and on men and women. But as you point out, women in the workplace in general have shouldered more this year. I know even just from my own household. So I have a 16-year-old boy and a 19-year-old boy. My 16-year-old is a junior in high school. My 19-year-old is a sophomore at Davidson. My husband is, again, very liberal minded. He went to, again, according to him, he went to med school to marry a doctor. And so we have a very balanced household. That said, I absorb more of the child care. It just has happened. And it's a lot that I have put on myself. And it's been really hard to balance my 16-year-old being at home. I've tried to work a fair amount at home, but I've been on service more this year than most years. I'm trying to balance doing interviews and making sure that my 16-year-old isn't falling asleep on his Zoom classes. And I think a lot of women have really spent more time in the home trying to make sure that their kids who can't be in school anymore, especially young kids who are not in school anymore. That's a lot. I don't know how we have a lot of young faculty who are in their 30s and 40s and have children that are especially in that age group of 8 to 12 where they really can't be at home by themselves. And normally they would be in school. I just feel like so much to shoulder and so much stress. For me, Amory probably knows this as well from last year. I do a gratitude exercise every night. I don't always write it down, but I always in my mind go through sort of a little meditation and thinking about what three things am I grateful for? And they could be silly things, they can be, but I try to make them very specific. I don't just say I'm grateful for my health. I really try to be very specific about what I'm grateful for every single day, because no matter how challenging the day is, there's always something, there's always a bright spot. There's always something to be grateful for. And I find that that just helps ground me a little bit. I often write them down. Sometimes I send them out to the residents in little writings to them, but that helps ground me.
At the beginning of the pandemic, when there was just so much uncertainty, she would send them out every single night. And I know a lot of us just look forward to getting them. And it was such a reminder when everything felt like it was changing and uncertain, just to have that there and to be reminded that amidst it all, and there's still so much to be thankful for.
Amory, what do you do for stress relief in this?
So I think at different times there have been different outlets. When I started my clinical years of medical school, it was a lot of heaviness. I was exposed to just really difficult situations, people that had poor access to the medical system and services, and saw a lot of just suffering and everything. And so that was really hard for me to know how to process that information. And so in that time, I took some time to just write down some poems and everything that helped me process them and try to give dignity to the patients that I care for. And I don't do it all the time, but even in residency, when there's been a really difficult night, one night I was alone at a smaller hospital and lost a patient unexpectedly and felt devastated. And in that moment, I just sat down and wrote down a poem, just reflecting on the difficulty of giving bad news and how finding the right words is really difficult. And in that moment, it helped me to process a situation because, you know, I still needed to take care of all the other patients and everything, but just taking some time to process it was really helpful.
Absolutely, Anne-Marie, that's so beautifully said. I cannot wait to hear and have the great opportunity of reading one of your poems. I'm sure it's as incredible as your diagnostic reasoning is. And I find that incredibly true as well about just like taking a moment to just process this during a busy day. I mean, especially like our job is so hard and, you know, taking care of patients, there's so many challenging situations that comes up. And I was like, try to hopefully empower my team as well to like, hey, if you need a moment, just take that moment. And as you mentioned, Dr. Bynum, is just like celebrating the little things in life. I'm a big fan of like celebrating once a patient is not constipated or anymore, or that hyponatremia is fixed. Just, you know, the little things makes a big difference during a busy day. And I couldn't agree with you both more. Thank you so much for sharing.
Well, thank you so much, Charmaine and Sarah and Dr. Bynum, who I am supposed to call Deb now, for just doing this and taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. This has been really fun.
Yeah.
Thank you both. I'm excited to do my own gratitude exercise tonight before I go to bed, and hopefully, I'm not much of a poet, but maybe I'll try my hand at that too in the coming days. As we close, it would be great to hear if you could both sort of turn back time and think about when you were embarking on your careers in medicine. If there's any advice that you could give to your former self, knowing what you know now, I'd be really interested to hear what you might tell her back then.
I think for me, I would tell myself two things. I think one is run your own race and don't compare yourself to others. We work among so many talented colleagues who all do amazing things and we rejoice in that, but sometimes it can feel a little intimidating, or you can feel like insufficient or get imposter syndrome. And so I think celebrating the victories of others, but also running your own race and not comparing yourself to what other people are achieving. And I guess on that note, also realizing that big things start with seeds and growth of substantial things take time. I think in residency, I really struggled to know who I was, what I wanted to do and everything like that. And I felt like sometimes that all my colleagues were out there doing amazing things and I was just struggling. But amidst that, just with deliberate practice and reading and reflecting and everything, I was planting the seeds, which, you know, I hope with time grows into something big. So I think just not putting a time frame on growth and just allowing it to happen organically and not feeling like that everything has to be achieved by the end of residency.
That's amazing, Anne-Marie. I think for me, if I could go back and knock my young self on the head when I was a college freshman, I think I would tell myself to just that you belong, that I belong where I was, and that I was good enough to be where I was, and that I was ready for the next step, whatever it was. I think I was the first person in my family to even graduate high school. So when I got to college, it started this whole cycle of me feeling like somehow I had pulled one over on somebody and they were going to find out. And then I was just going to be sent back home. And it took a while for me to realize I didn't pull one over on anyone. I deserved to be where I was. And that everybody, and I think this took me a long time to realize that the people, Anne-Marie, all those people you feel like are around you that seem like they have it together, everybody has their issues and their struggles. And I think over the last 20 years or so, as I've been a faculty member and I've been in roles where I've been fortunate and blessed to work with medical students and residents and fellows, and I get to meet with everybody one-on-one, and I get to meet with these people who are absolutely amazing. They've done amazing things. They all have their inner struggles. And a lot of us struggle with this. Again, the imposter syndrome. I wish I had a name. I wish I had known the term imposter syndrome when I was 20 years old, because it is absolutely so important to realize what it is and to see it when it's happening. But that's what I would go back and knock myself on the head and just say, just stop right now. Everybody has these doubts. Some people cover it better than others, and you do deserve to be where you are, and you are ready for the next step.
I don't have any words to say other than that was so incredibly powerful. Thank you. There are a lot of things I'm grateful for being part of the community of women physicians like you all. It's definitely one of the biggest things I'm grateful for. So thank you.
That's a wrap, folks.